today on Against the Grain. What was the modern sanctuary movement formed to do? What challenges did it face? And how did activists respond to government repression? I'm CS. Carl Linskog describes the evolution and expansion of the sanctuary movement coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. It hasn't been easy. Government prosecution and persecution of sanctuary movement activists have taken their toll. Waves of anti-immigrant hysteria and racial violence have taxed movement resources and tested people's resolve. U.S. foreign policy and military intervention in Central America and beyond have displaced millions of people, spurring many to seek asylum in the U.S. So what does sanctuary mean and encompass? What spurred the founding of the modern sanctuary movement in the 1980s? How has it changed and evolved over the years? And how has it responded to the many challenges and roadblocks it's encountered? Carl Linskog has investigated the history of the sanctuary movement, including its expansion into a far-reaching campaign for human rights, economic justice, and peace. Linskog is an activist and associate professor of history at Raritan Valley Community College in New Jersey. He contributed a chapter titled "Sanctuary is Justice: Resilience and Ingenuity in the Sanctuary Movement Since 1986" to the volume "Who's America? U.S. Immigration Policy Since 1980, edited by Maria Cristina Garcia and Madalena Marinari. When Carl Linskog and I connected recently, I asked what he hoped to achieve with his chapter.
My purpose and hope for this chapter and for the readers who engage with it would be to recover and to teach some things about the sanctuary movement of the 1980s, and connect it with the sometimes called the new sanctuary movement or the contemporary sanctuary movement, but most of all to talk about and to teach about what's less known than either the historical or the contemporary sanctuary movement, and that is this connective period where sanctuary for Central American asylum seekers became all these other things, a wide-ranging activism that really grew out of the sanctuary movement of the 1980s, and provided then when it was time for the new sanctuary movement to emerge, a really rich and fertile ground out of which a new generation or a new tradition of sanctuary could grow.
Let's dial it back to the early 1980s. What did an Arizona-based rancher named Jim Corbett begin doing then to help refugees from El Salvador?
Jim Corbett was part of a community that was concerned about the U.S.-backed violence in Central America, in El Salvador. And he was alarmed to find desperate people showing up in the Sonoran Desert, and assumed that the United States would be a place of refuge for them, particularly because they were fleeing violence that the United States government had contributed substantially toward. He famously went to check on a Central American asylum seeker or migrant in detention to check on the status of this person, and found out that he had been detained and he was being deported back to El Salvador, which Corbett found to be just unconscionable. And so he started to think about what could be done, what must be done in response to the U.S. government's disregard for the lives and the rights of Salvadorans coming seeking refuge in this country. And so he put out a call for the creation of a network that he likened to the Underground Railroad of the 19th century, whereby church people, people of faith, and solidarity activists would provide a sanctuary to those coming here and seeking asylum and refuge from U.S.-backed violence in their home countries.
And remind us what role the U.S. played in creating turmoil in El Salvador from which people wanted to flee.
The United States in the early 1980s was pursuing a policy of a late Cold War policy where it was trying to suppress radicalism and also radical movements that threatened its geopolitical and its economic interests in the regions. This is something the United States had done for decades by this point, going back to 1954 with a U.S.-backed coup in Guatemala and into the 1960s and 70s throughout Central and South America. But by the early 1980s, the Reagan administration was providing aid to very repressive government of El Salvador, which was trying to root out and repress a revolutionary movement that was trying to seek justice and a more equitable distribution of land and power in a very inequitable and unjust country. It was also the United States' reaction to a successful revolution in Nicaragua in 1979, which had posed a real challenge to American interests in the region, and this is why the United States supports and funds counter-revolutionaries, known as the Contras, to try to roll back the revolution there. And it goes right hand in hand with the United States government funding and training and support for violent repression of revolutionaries in El Salvador in the same period.
And people were also fleeing Guatemala for the U.S. in the 1980s. Why was that? What was the U.S. doing in relation and in that country?
The U.S. policy and relationship towards Guatemala was very similar to that of El Salvador, in that it was arming and supporting a repressive government that was in that country too, trying to roll back and to resist revolutionary forces in Guatemala as well. And the same thing then happened when it came to people fleeing violence and war, and that was Guatemalans, like Salvadorans, started fleeing in large numbers to other countries in the region, as well as to the United States. And so Guatemalan asylum seekers became another important group that was identified by and then supported by the U.S. sanctuary movement.
And despite the fact that the U.S. government could expect that their policies in Central America would have this effect of making people want to get out of their home countries and move to places like the U.S., despite that, the U.S. government was not friendly toward refugees. It was not interested in granting asylum.
That's correct. The Reagan administration was unwilling to recognize the legitimacy of Salvadoran and Guatemalan asylum seekers as legitimate political refugees. It had an obligation to, as sanctuary activists pointed out, acknowledge that they were legitimate refugees and asylum seekers fleeing fear of persecution. But because of the United States' geostrategic, geopolitical interests in the region, and acknowledging and accepting them as legitimate political refugees would be an acknowledgement that the very governments that the United States was supporting and arming were driving their own people from their homelands. And so that would stand in stark contrast to its geopolitical interests in the region. And the Reagan administration was also, you know, drawing upon and responding to a racist and nativist backlash in the 1980s against immigrants and foreign-born people. A lot of this really picked up speed following the Caribbean refugee crisis of 1980, which brought more than 100,000 Cubans to American shores and 15,000 or so Haitians in the same period. So it's international relations, America's imperial interests in the period, as well as domestic politics of racism and nativism that contributed to the Reagan administration's decision to reject Salvadorans and Guatemalans and to instead classify them as economic migrants and thus not deserving or being entitled to the protections that the asylum and refugee system allowed.
So we have the rancher, Jim Corbett, calling for a new Underground Railroad to help refugees. We also have Southside Presbyterian Church in Tucson, Arizona, which made a public declaration of sanctuary in 1982 on March 24th. What prompted this church to make this declaration, and what did the declaration mean?
Southside Presbyterian Church, along with about four other churches, issued a public declaration of sanctuary, notifying the U.S. government and really everyone who was willing to listen that they were going to take a principled stance of what they called civil initiative, which differed from civil disobedience in that they were not, in their minds, breaking an unjust law, which is the basis for civil disobedience, but they were actually the ones upholding the law, and it was the United States government and the Reagan administration that was breaking both U.S. federal law and international law by ignoring their obligation to give refuge to those fleeing legitimate political persecution. And so when they issued this declaration and said, we are going to provide sanctuary to those people from Central America that are coming here, they were putting the government on notice that someone was going to push back against the lawlessness of the U.S. government, and they were in effect putting out a clarion call for solidarity and inviting others to join this sanctuary network and the sanctuary campaign, which soon many faith communities and churches and individuals and organizations did.
That's Carl Lindskog. He is associate history professor at Raritan Valley Community College in New Jersey, and he contributed a chapter about the history of the sanctuary movement to the volume Who's America? U.S. Immigration Policy Since 1980. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. What needs to be said about the pace with which the sanctuary movement grew across the U.S.?
The sanctuary movement grew pretty rapidly. After some years in existence and a lot of hard work, especially including by Salvadorans who provided testimony and were central, not always recognized, but were central parts of the sanctuary movement. Pretty soon there were hundreds of churches that were part of the sanctuary network. And part of the reason, too, in terms of how quickly and widespread the sanctuary movement became, was also the growing outrage and indignation over what was happening in Central America and especially El Salvador. And the sanctuary movement's partnership with a Central American peace and solidarity movement that was really putting increasing pressure on the government and drawing increasing attention to, you know, what exactly was happening there and what the U.S. role in it was. So I think we can explain the pretty rapid and widespread growth of the sanctuary movement to the deep concern about what's happening in Central America, its partnership with the Central American Peace and Solidarity Movement, and the really indispensable role that especially Salvadoran asylum seekers played in bringing the story to U.S. Americans and providing testimony and giving a very concrete example of what had happened and what that experience was like and how responsible the United States was for that.
So on a concrete level, when a church made a public declaration of sanctuary, was it saying or was it committing to physically protecting refugees who found their way into, for example, the place of worship, the actual sanctuary of a certain church, Or did it vary in terms of what the church was actually saying it would do in the face of possible government action against refugees?
Not all churches or synagogues or temples or faith communities that joined the sanctuary movement and made declarations of sanctuary ended up providing physical sanctuary to people who needed protection and shelter. I think especially in the 1980s, those churches that took that sanctuary pledge, that committed to join the movement, there was more of an understanding that they were prepared, if need be, to take that step. But it was more than that. It was also the statement of support and solidarity with the goals of the movement, with the principles of the movement. And most ended up providing support in other ways, hosting events, adding their names to statements, sometimes helping to transport people who were moving from one region or from one community to another. There were lots of different ways that sanctuary churches and sanctuary communities provided support beyond providing physical sanctuary. But with that said, a number of that did end up taking the sanctuary pledge and joining the sanctuary movement did, at least for a time, provide physical sanctuary to people who needed protection at that time from arrest and deportation.
As you note, the government tried to disrupt and destroy the sanctuary movement. What tactics and methods did it use against the movement?
The government did have quite a campaign against the sanctuary movement, as well as against the Central American Peace and Solidarity movement. In some ways, it wasn't nearly as violent or widespread as the repression that was going on in Central America, but in some ways it might be seen as an extension of the counter-revolutionary or the counter-insurgency efforts that the government was supporting in Central America. The violence and the intensity of what was happening in the 1980s there, I think, influenced and shaped the extent to which the government was willing to go in the United States to try to suppress the movement here. And so the government deployed a number of methods to try to disrupt and destroy the sanctuary and Central American movements. One of those was a continuation of the same sorts of things they had done during the 1960s and 70s during COINTELPRO, or the counterintelligence program, which was to intimidate, to try to surveil, and to try to disrupt the networks of, during COINTELPRO, it was anti-war activists, Black Power and Black Freedom Struggle activists, and others. They did the similar things against the sanctuary movement. So breaking into churches and offices, leaving evidence that they had been there by rifling files. There were, according to one journalist who investigated this, more than 200 break-ins and lots of evidence of surveillance. They also infiltrated the sanctuary movement, which was the key piece of what was called Operation Sojourner. They had people working for the government that infiltrated the movement, that attended meetings, that attended worship services, that became confidants of some activists who then were reporting back to the government the activities and the internal discussions of the sanctuary movement. That became the basis for federal prosecution of sanctuary leaders and activists, which took place in several different phases. The most high-profile one was the Arizona sanctuary cases, where they brought federal charges against a number of leaders of the sanctuary movement and actually won convictions.
Yeah, you're right about the convictions obtained by the government against Reverend John Fife and seven other Arizona defendants in 1986. The convictions did not lead to incarceration. The defendants got probation. What legal strategy was developed by sanctuary movement activists that constituted, as you write, a counteroffensive against the government?
The counteroffensive that sanctuary activists were able to develop during and in the wake of the Arizona trials was one of the most surprising outgrowths of this history, I think, because whereas sometimes activists attempts to stop the government from doing something harmful or illegal can lead the government to circumvent and find new ways and often worse ways to carry out its intentions. In this case, government repression or attempts to repress and disrupt the movement led to a growth and a counteroffensive by the movement itself. The key thing that led to that was the fact that the court proceedings and the judge hearing the Arizona sanctuary trial didn't allow them to bring certain types of evidence into the courtroom, evidence of the violence that was being carried out in El Salvador, and especially what was motivating sanctuary activists that were on trial to take the steps they had taken, which of course sanctuary activists regarded and the defendants regarded as absolutely essential evidence to present in their own defense. When the judge refused to allow that evidence to be entered into that trial, it helped the defendants and their supporters realize that if they couldn't present that in the criminal proceedings, then they would need to find a new way to use it. And this prompted them to build a civil case against the U.S. government, which they did and ultimately won major successes in striking back against the government's repression of their constitutionally protected activities, as well as what was happening in places like El Salvador.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Carl Linskog is my guest, Linskoog. He is an historian, activist, and educator. He's author of Detain and Punish, Haitian Refugees and the Rise of the World's Largest Immigration Detention System. And we are talking about a chapter he contributed to the volume Who's America? U.S. Immigration Policy Since 1980. The chapter addresses the history of the sanctuary movement. I think the civil cases you were talking about were American Baptist Churches versus Thornburg and Presbyterian Church USA versus United States of America. Briefly, what were those cases about? You make clear in this chapter that they turned out very well for the sanctuary movement.
The American Baptist Churches case, sometimes known as ABC case, was basically advancing the demands of the sanctuary and Central American peace and solidarity movements, which was calling for a suspension of deportations to El Salvador and Guatemala on the grounds that the U.S. government was violating the rights of the asylum seekers and violating its own obligations under federal and international law. The Presbyterian Church case was suing the government for infringing on its constitutionally protected free exercise of religion. Of course, we have in our Constitution a First Amendment which protects freedom of religion, and the plaintiffs in that case claimed that when the government is surveilling and infiltrating communities and houses of worship, it is a violation of that free exercise of religion. So those were the two main claims or issues that were being advanced in these two really important cases.
And I understand that the ABC case, the result, the decision, open the possibility of asylum for a lot of refugees?
Yes, the ABC case eventually led to an agreement between the government and the activists that were bringing that case. There was a possibility, as the case unfolded, that the government would have to go and give a deposition to provide evidence in the civil suit, and they didn't want to have to go on record, you know, divulging all the things that the government had been doing and was involved in. And so instead, the government settled the case and, as a part of that settlement, agreed to stop deporting Salvadoran and Guatemalan asylum seekers back to those countries that were so devastated by war and violence. That was a major demand of the civil suit, of course, and the major goal of the whole movement. They provided some legal protections and legal status changes for Salvadorans and Guatemalans, as well as a fair and a new process for a path towards asylum, to seek asylum, and even work permits while they were seeking asylum in those cases. So those were very substantial demands that the movement had been demanding all the time, and it was ultimately the ABC case, you know, in conjunction with and supported by this long history of activism, that finally succeeded in forcing the government to make those concessions.
You note in your chapter the ebbing in the 1990s of the Central American refugee crisis. Why was that, and what did that mean for sanctuary movement activists?
The conflicts in El Salvador and Guatemala, and some of the political concerns that the government had in Nicaragua, started to come to a close in the early 1990s, early to mid-1990s. So in 1990, there was an election that led to a political change that the U.S. government found more acceptable in Nicaragua. And more importantly for the sanctuary movement, in 1992, there was a negotiated peace in El Salvador, and in 1996, a peace agreement in Guatemala. So those long and terrible conflicts that had destroyed those countries and the region and had led to the driving out of asylum seekers and the basis for the sanctuary movement came to a close. And so that started to suggest that the sanctuary movement could start looking in new directions.
And yet the movement was not out of danger. You write about a new nativism that emerged in the 1990s. Did this have to do with some of the legislation, the federal legislation passed in that decade?
Yes. Even before new legislation, there was a growing anti-immigrant and nativist sentiment that was welling up even before the 1990s, in the 1980s, as we've discussed. But certainly by 1990 and into the mid-1990s, there's a growing sense of anti-immigrant and nativist politics that, as has often happened in the past, takes the form of anti-immigrant legislation. The most important goes into effect in 1996. This is the articulation of the virulent anti-immigrant sentiment that had been welling up for a good 15 years or so. And it really makes legal immigrants and unauthorized immigrants and asylum seekers and refugees much, much more vulnerable. And the movement that had grown out of the sanctuary movement sees these changes and decides that it needs to react to defend and to be in solidarity with some of these people in a similar way that it had done with Central American asylum seekers in the 1980s.
Yeah, the 1996 law was the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act. And I think one point you make about the sanctuary movement in the 1990s is that it reached out to the broader immigrant rights movement. How significant was this?
It's very significant because in some ways it combines different threads of movements in solidarity with and support for asylum seekers that had existed before this coming together in the 1990s. I've also written about Haitian asylum seekers in the 1970s and 80s and into the 1990s. And at the same time that Salvadoran asylum seekers are being arrested and deported back to El Salvador, asylum seekers from Haiti are coming, and they're also really at the very origins of the modern anti-immigrant moment. And in the 1990s, the sanctuary movement, as it needs to not focus quite so much on Central America, a lot of sanctuary activists are starting to become more aware of Haiti. This is also in part because there's a military coup in the early 1990s in Haiti that's sending a whole new of tens of thousands of Haitian asylum seekers to American shores. And just as the U.S. government had done in the 1980s towards Salvadorans and Guatemalans, the Bush, George H.W. Bush administrations and then the Clinton administrations are closing the door to Haitian asylum seekers, despite what's going on back in Haiti and the legitimacy of their claims for political refuge and asylum. And so the sanctuary movement, now having not to be so preoccupied with Central America, turns its attention in part to Haiti, and it starts to do a lot of solidarity work and support for Haitian asylum seekers. And so this is one of the ways that what happens in the 1990s, outgrowth of the sanctuary movement, becomes very significant.
Corporate globalization and neoliberal capitalism were emerging as big targets of activism and agitation in the 1990s. To what extent were those kinds of big picture processes the focus of sanctuary movement activists in the 1990s?
What's remarkable is how many groups saw such a clear connection between their work in solidarity with Central American asylum seekers and those who were struggling for peace and freedom in Central America in the 1980s, and the struggle against corporate globalization and neoliberal capitalism in the mid to later 1990s. Their publications and their correspondence really shines a light on how they understood this relationship, and a theme that emerges time and again suggests that whereas America's imperial violence in the 1980s took the form of funding and training death squads to advance American interests and then to exclude the victims of that violence once they reached American borders in the 1980s, with the ends of those conflicts and the conclusion of the Cold War and the supposed hegemony of capitalism, you know, globally as the only game in town, now it was going to take a different shape. American empire and American advancing its own interests against the interests of many people in different parts of the world, including in Latin America, was going to take a different shape as they understood it. And imposing free trade agreements and structural adjustment policies, that was also a form of violence. And so they started to understand not just that we needed to stand up for labor rights or for just negotiations of economic agreements, but also to be in solidarity with the people in those countries most affected and with the places that were on the front lines of fighting back. And so for this reason, some of the sanctuary groups that were very active in the 1980s identified with the, for example, the Zapatista rebellion and revolution in the starting in 1994 in southern Mexico, because they said just as there were people struggling for freedom in El Salvador in the 1980s that they wanted to provide solidarity with, the Zapatistas and others recognized that this was the new face of American and capitalist empire, and they needed to be in solidarity with them just as they had been in the 1980s.
That's the voice of Carl Linskoog. He teaches history at Raritan Valley Community College, and he contributed a chapter about the history of the sanctuary movement in the U.S. to the volume Who's America? U.S. Immigration Policy Since 1980, edited by Maria Cristina Garcia and Madalena Marinari. It's published by the University of Illinois Press. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Yeah, you're right about Valley Religious Task Force in Phoenix supporting the Zapatistas and arranging friendship caravans to Cuba. And sanctuary activists also, you write, focus their attention on the situation of workers in Central America. Tell us about that.
They identified labor struggles in Central America as one of the key ways that people were fighting for dignity and also self-determination, just as they had the revolutionary movements had been in the earlier period in Central America. And so even though it wasn't in the context of a civil war, fighting for labor rights, which also could be a very dangerous and deadly process, was seen as pursuing the same goals and advancing the same principles and rights. And so there were a number of activities in the United States throughout the 1990s to draw attention to and support labor activists and to provide solidarity with labor campaigns in Central America and throughout Latin America. And it was some of these same sanctuary activists and organizations that became more focused on labor and labor rights in this period.
Two organizations grew directly out of sanctuary activism of the 1980s. I'm referring here to the Samaritans, who launched a project in 2000 called Humane Borders, and a new organization that emerged called No More Deaths. Tell us about those projects.
Samaritans and No More Deaths both grow out of the very same community that was the birthplace of the sanctuary movement of the 1980s in southern Arizona. It's some of the same activists and churches and organizations that look at the situation in the 1990s and early 2000s and reconfigure the type of solidarity and support and resistance that is required at that moment. These two organizations are really a response to the changing geoeconomic moment in terms of neoliberalism and free trade policies, as well as new border enforcement policies and practices like Operation Gatekeeper. There was a new idea in the 1990s by the US government to really reinforce and close off the main border crossings on the US-Mexico border. And they hoped, therefore, cut down substantially on the number of unauthorized border crossings. But what it actually did was drove migrants and people crossing borders to much more remote areas of the border, including through deserts and very dangerous conditions. This led to a humanitarian catastrophe for these people because so many people were dying in the Sonoran Desert trying to reach the United States. You can get a sense of how urgent it was that they be able to enter and seek assistance and reconnect with family sometimes or earn a livelihood. But this, much like in the early 1980s when Salvadorans were showing up in the Sonoran Desert, this crisis in the Sonoran Desert and along the US-Mexico border led to these two organizations, Samaritans and No More Death. And it was new efforts by these organizations and their activists to provide humanitarian assistance and support for those crossing so that they wouldn't die en route to the United States. And so they provided things like food and water and different kinds of support for migrants coming through that area.
You write about the formation of a new sanctuary movement in early 2007 in Washington, D.C. Activists came together then and there. What prompted them to create or initiate a new movement? And what did that have to do with the huge historic 2006 protests on the streets of Chicago, LA, and other places, and the consequences of those protests?
The new sanctuary movement, or sometimes we might think about it as the reemergent sanctuary movement that is formed in 2007, is a response to a new threat to immigrants and foreign-born people in this country. It goes back to 1996, as we discussed for sure, and the growing anti-immigrant laws and politics and practices. It's in part a response as well to changes after the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, and new targeting in the name of national security now of, you know, migrant and immigrant communities. But in 2006, it was a watershed moment in some ways, because there was a proposal for a harsh new anti-immigrant law out of the House of Representatives. It was called H.R. 4437, known as the Sensenbrenner Bill for the Wisconsin Republican that sponsored it. And that proposed to make all people in the United States without authorization to be here into felons. And not only that, but to make anyone who supported them, whether giving them food or water, giving them a ride to work, giving them shelter, also felons. So the Good Samaritan, you know, to use the name of one of these new organizations that came out in 2000, and just the immigrants in the United States without authorization were to all become felons according to this proposal, this new law proposed. And it led to a very historic uprising and outswell of support, you know, of opposition, I should say, by immigrant communities all across the nation, protests, and such a extent of opposition that it really stopped the bill in its tracks. That led to a new awareness of a new immigrant rights movement, but it also provoked a new backlash in this ever back and forth exchange between government repression and government power and immigrant rights activism. And this kind of dynamic of a huge swell in support for immigrant rights, but also a new chapter in backlash and repression, helped to inform the consciousness of activists that maybe it was time to think about forming a new sanctuary movement that would be somewhat more tuned into the political realities of the time.
A number of notable cases of actual sanctuary in places of worship. What did the sanctuary movement do to help Rosa Robles Loreto and her family? And I think this was a Southside Presbyterian in Arizona, right?
Yes. There were two early cases of sanctuary back at the birthplace of the sanctuary movement in Southside Presbyterian in Tucson. They gave physical sanctuary to Daniel and Rosa and allowed them to stay in sanctuary until they could have a guarantee that they were going to have safety in the community. And this was in 2014, and it helped to sort of reestablish the practice of physical sanctuary. It wasn't the first time after the reemergence of the sanctuary movement in 2007 that had been done. There was a much earlier case in Chicago that drew a lot of attention and got people thinking again about sanctuary, and that was another thing that helped sort of establish the reemergence of the sanctuary movement. But this case in 2014 was an important one because it got people and activists and faith communities especially thinking about bringing back the practice in a much more widespread way of physical sanctuary for vulnerable people.
Carl Linskoog joins us on Against the Grain. He is an activist and educator and an historian based at Raritan Valley Community College in New Jersey. My name is C.S. Song. So, Carl, we were talking about how in the 1990s, the sanctuary movement acted in solidarity with a number of other movements, whether it was movements against neoliberalism or corporate globalization, movements that were trying to advance immigrant rights more generally, movements that were supporting workers and labor activists in Central America. And yet you're right that elements of today's sanctuary movement are advancing a more expansive and radical vision of sanctuary. So I assume this moves beyond the vistas that were engaged with in the 1990s. Tell us about what's happening more recently.
It seems like there are several threads of today's sanctuary movement or different elements. And of course, that was true of the historical sanctuary movement too. There are some organizations that have a narrower view, that have a more domestically focused more traditional view of advocating for immigrant rights, working within the political system, or being primarily concerned with providing physical sanctuary or other kinds of legal protections for, you know, asylum seekers or immigrants that are seeking stays of deportation. And those organizations and those elements of the movement are providing essential work. But there are also other elements of the movement that are connecting today's sanctuary movement to other social movements that are seeking much more thoroughgoing, radical, sort of foundational change. Of course, after the murder of George Floyd, the uprisings called to abolish the police or abolish prisons, or to think much more fundamentally about, you know, what it would really take for us to be free and to live in a society that had true justice. Those more radical and visionary movements are sometimes connecting with, and sanctuary activists are sometimes connecting with those movements. And so they're thinking about now not just immigrant rights or the rights of asylum seekers, but also how is our limited asylum system or the violence along the U.S. Border Patrol related to anti-Black violence? How is it related to, you know, imperial violence abroad or the U.S., you know, U.S.-backed wars in Yemen or what's happening with Palestinians? How are border walls here related to border walls in Gaza? There are some activists and organizations that are going beyond the more limited view of today's sanctuary movement to try to connect it to much more thoroughgoing movements. And it's those activists and those elements of the movement today that I think are really embracing the radical spirit of the sanctuary movement of the 1980s.
So how would you sum up what you've learned by going through and writing about the history of this movement in the sense of the movement's resilience, its ability to sustain itself despite government repression, and you know, the ways in which it's been able to come up with new strategies and tactics in its effort to help refugees?
The level of violence that the government unleashed on Central Americans, particularly Salvadorans and Guatemalans in the 1980s, and then the violence that they unleashed against asylum seekers who were trying to seek asylum and refuge in the United States was horrifying. And so was the anti-immigrant initiatives and the recent and current violence against immigrants and migrants, whether on the U.S.-Mexico border or elsewhere, the banning of refugees, a whole violent system of cruelty that really targets people on the outside, people of color, and immigrants. But the takeaway for me of learning this story is very inspiring and actually very hopeful, because it shows that people found a way, despite all this, despite the power of the state, to resist, to provide solidarity, to do real peace work, and they prevailed. They survived government repression. They actually won victories in devising new strategies to push back against that government repression. As much harm as there has been done by the anti-immigrant initiatives and the imperial initiatives of the U.S. government in recent years, new movements and new strategies have emerged that connect freedom struggles of asylum seekers, for example, with workers' rights in other parts of the world, with people trying to expose, you know, U.S. support for military regimes, with people trying to provide aid to countries and groups that are seeking independence and self-determination. And then with the emergence of the modern sanctuary movement, it really shows me as a historian and also as an activist that there's a lineage, and that what people have done before helped plant the seeds for contemporary efforts, and activists and people who are concerned about these matters should appreciate that today we're planting the seeds for future movements for freedom and justice that will be coming down the road.
And any sense of how many faith communities and congregations belong to the sanctuary movement these days?
Today there are more than 1,000. That huge surge in the number of sanctuary communities took place in the years following Trump's election to the presidency. And there are many more organizations and groups that might not call themselves a sanctuary coalition or a sanctuary church that are really doing the work of an expanded sanctuary, which means so much more today than just providing physical sanctuary or political advocacy for immigrants or asylum seekers. So the sanctuary movement definitely numbers in the thousands now today, and it's an expanding and ever re-energizing and ambitious movement that provides a lot of hope in a sometimes discouraging world.
Carl Linskog, again, Linskoog, Associate History Professor at Raritan Valley Community College. He is an activist as well, author of Detain and Punish, Haitian Refugees and the Rise of the World's Largest Immigration Detention System. And you can find in the volume, Who's America? U.S. Immigration Policy Since 1980, a chapter Carl contributed about the history of the sanctuary movement. Carl, thank you for your work and for joining us today.
Thank you for this opportunity. I really appreciate it.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.